Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey, folks, got a bit of a special episode for you today. Every fall for the past several years, The Weeds has been going to the Texas Tribune Festival in Austin, doing a special live episode there. This year, of course, there is no such live festival for us to go to, but the festival has still been happening virtually, and we were really excited to participate. What we have for you is a sort of a group interview with Representative Veronica Escobar. She represents district based in El Paso, Texas, around the border. We were able to talk with her about the impact of the COVID pandemic on the Latino community, about the situation at the border right now, about the political future of Texas, a lot of really fascinating, interesting issues. We're really glad to be a part of Texas Tribune Festival every year. And so here it is. I think you're going to like this interview. Hello, welcome to another episode of The Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. We are coming to you not exactly live today from the Texas Tribune Festival, where we have been doing episodes for the past several years. Usually we come down to Austin, we have some breakfast tacos, it's a great time. This year, obviously, everything is a little bit different, but I am here with Jane Costin, ProPublica's Dara Lind, and also a special guest, Representative Veronica Escobar. She represents the 16th Congressional District in Texas, which is the El Paso and environs. And we're really glad to have you with us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Matt. It's totally my privilege. And what you guys usually have when you go to Austin, even though Austinites call them breakfast tacos, they're breakfast burritos, really. Just FYI.
All right. Can you explain this to us? Like, what is a West Texas breakfast taco and what makes it different?
Well, so to me, a taco is like a regular taco, right? A corn tortilla with a filling that's fried. In fact, I made some last night. What I get in Austin when I order a breakfast taco is a flour tortilla with the filling wrapped up, which is a burrito. But anyhow, I don't mean to sidetrack.
My wife is from San Antonio, so you know she has strong feelings about this. And
yeah, I have very strong feelings about food in general.
A lot always in the mix in Texas. Something you mentioned before the show that I thought we should talk about is some of the disparities in COVID incidents. We're joking around here, but obviously we're not doing the festival live. This is a very serious situation in the country. And I don't think we've actually talked that much about the incidents in the Latino community, which is heavily represented in your district and obviously in Texas broadly. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, you know, Matt, and you're right. I mean, this is a really serious issue, a deadly one, in fact, for minority communities like mine. You, early on in the COVID crisis, the Congressional Hispanic Caucus had a Zoom conversation with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is the head of the president's task force, COVID task force. And the number one question was, tell us what we can expect the impact to be on Latino communities. And this was probably late March, maybe early April. So this was, you know, everything had just recently been shut down. And we were still learning a lot. It still is the novel coronavirus, but it was even more novel at that point. But something that he said made my jaw drop. He said that literally Latino communities are as vulnerable to getting sick and dying from COVID as are people in assisted living facilities and nursing homes. That's how vulnerable Latinos are. And so, you know, that is an alarm that went off for all of us. I began sounding the alarm in El Paso and in Texas that we really needed a specific strategy for Latino communities. But as you all know, in Texas, we had a governor whose emphasis was an economic recovery instead of a healthcare recovery. Governor Greg Abbott chose to open up the state of Texas when we were not even at 1% of testing. We had not even tested 1% of the population. There was no plan in place for vulnerable communities, neither, you know, the assisted living facilities and nursing homes, nor vulnerable communities that are heavily populated by Latinos or African Americans. And so we immediately became a hotspot. And unfortunately, things have not changed. And while we're seeing a leveling off, and that has changed, and that's improving a little bit, although, you know, we have to wait and see what's going to happen as the cold weather comes in. What has not changed is the disproportionate impact on minorities and minority communities. We are communities that mostly have essential workers, communities where Latinos have a high incidence of comorbidities, and very little access to health insurance. And in the state of Texas, where we have state leaders fighting to basically do away with the Affordable Care Act, we are obviously not a state that expanded access to health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. So any way that you look at it, any way you slice it, it has been absolutely devastating for Latinos, especially Latinos in Texas.
So Texas did not do a Medicaid expansion, is what you were referring to there, right?
That's
so
right.
That's, I mean, Texas is the second largest state in the union, has a relatively high poverty rate. And so probably the biggest slice of uninsured people, one of the biggest slices left in the country, is the Texas and Florida Medicaid expansion eligible populations, where that hasn't been done. Now, I wonder, do you know what accounts for the sort of disproportionate vulnerability in the Latino community? Is it about the occupational structure? Is it overcrowded housing? What kind of situations are we looking at?
It's really three things, Matt. Number one, you're right, the employment situation. Essential workers didn't have the luxury of staying home and working behind a laptop or a computer. That just did not exist for many Latinos. Secondly, we are sicker because of generations of lack of access to health coverage and health insurance. We have more comorbidities. So, for example, you know, more folks that have diabetes and heart disease, or, you know, various different combinations of deadly diseases. And third, we have less access to health insurance and to primary health care than white communities. And, you know, I learned something really interesting last week that just tells you how preventable this vulnerability is. We had an Armed Services Committee hearing where the focus was the DOD's work on COVID. And so, you know, there were a lot of questions about PPE and other things. So the question that I asked, because I was so curious, because as we know, people in the military, our active service members, have access to healthcare when they are in active service. So I asked, are you all keeping in the military, are you all keeping demographic data? And the answer was, yes, we are keeping demographic data. My follow-up question was, are you finding the same, essentially the same disproportionate impact among our Latino service members that we see out in the civilian world? Their answer was fascinating, but not surprising. They said, actually, no, because they have access to healthcare. That was their response. Mm. And so the incredible tragedy of so much, and, you know, obviously it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that, but it just really underlies the needlessness of so many deaths. You know, so much of this could have been prevented, especially for vulnerable populations. And so it just compounds that tragedy.
One of the challenges, you mentioned a little bit about how Governor Abbott has really discouraged localities from making their own decisions on coronavirus. That's an experience that people have had in Austin, Dallas, Houston. Can you talk a little bit about how challenging it has been or not to work with state-level government and state-level leadership on this issue when you are hearing time and again that what the governor values, as you said, is an economic comeback?
I have not dealt with the governor directly, but I have been in contact with the Office of Emergency Management at the state level and at the local level, because that's where, you know, sort of all of the action comes through. And early on, had a phone conversation when after speaking with Dr. Fauci, they're the folks that I wanted to sound the alarm to say, look, this is what Dr. Fauci has told us. It should be alarming to all of us. We need a specific plan. The only way to address the vulnerability, according to Dr. Fauci, and I shared this with the state, was to flood vulnerable communities with resources. So in other words, before we reopened, and I offered these suggestions, before reopening, all essential workers should be tested. That's when you should do aggressive and robust testing and tracing, because you're able to track folks who go home and are in contact with their family, making sure that folks who are asymptomatic can get tested. And actually, we really didn't have a target on all essential workers, but the more testing was kind of slow rolled. And in fact, it felt almost as though in the early period of the pandemic, that folks like Governor Abbott and President Trump really didn't want testing, because if the numbers came back high, they saw that as a negative. And so early on, when the governor reopened very quickly in his desire to get the economy back on track, and we were seeing more positive cases, he didn't blame the reopening. He blamed the fact that there were more tests that were being provided to the public. And so it's been this incredibly frustrating experience to have folks in office who are ignoring the alarms that are going off all around us and are really far more interested in saving the economy than in saving lives.
Something that is, I think, generally a problem when we talk about disparate impacts, but that has really been clear through this pandemic, especially with the concentration of Latinos in like certain essential occupations, is that when you talk about the disparity, it can become very easy to kind of pathologize, right? Like in various places, certainly in the upper Midwest and also kind of down here in the South, there's been a kind of tendency to say, well, the problem is that there are too many, that like Latinos don't live healthily, that they live too close together. And so they're really getting it. They're not getting it from work. It's not an issue of workplace conditions. They're just getting it from home. And I think, related to that, a narrative has taken hold among, some on the left and center left that Republicans stopped caring about the coronavirus once it became clear that it would disproportionately impact Black and Latino communities. And like, without litigating the like what was in people's hearts or any of that, there is a tension. How do you call attention to the disparate impacts that something is having on particular underserved communities without making it seem like a Latino issue or encouraging people to ignore it as if it doesn't apply to them?
Yeah, Dara, that has been so frustrating for me as well. And I want to give you an example. And I think the root problem is that we have far too many people who are making statements, people who have a bully pulpit who are making statements based on assumptions instead of the information we have in front of us. And so I'll give you an example, an El Paso example that I find frustrating. So a couple weeks ago, Bob Moore, who many of you are probably familiar with, great, amazing journalist who started an online news source called El Paso Matters. He had this incredible story about how the city of El Paso for months had not enforced any of the rules, basically, you know. And so bars were operating, you know, if they're supposed to at least pretend that they're serving food, there were bars operating without doing that, without enforcing any kind of social distancing or mask wearing, you know, when you're not eating or drinking, and kind of, you know, documented the spike in the cases that happened when our local government chose not to enforce the rules. Well, what happens when you don't enforce the rules, you know, is that more than likely people aren't going to follow the rules in bars and other places where they're closely confined. So there was that great story. And then a week later, you have the mayor of the city of El Paso saying, we don't want another spike in our COVID cases during this Labor Day weekend, you know, sort of blaming families who get together. And there's just something in that that is so offensive to me, because it feeds that assumption that, oh, well, you know, Hispanic families, they just can't stay away from each other. And, you know, they're going to go ahead and have parties, et cetera. And yet, what about the local government's obligation to enforce the rules to prevent the spread? We saw spikes, you know, in part because of that unwillingness.
How do you address that from a local government perspective? You're in Congress now, but you were in local government for a long time. You were county judge, which I know enough about Texas. It's not a judge. It's a county executive. You know, when here in D.C., you know, my son is not able to go to kindergarten, but bars and restaurants are open, and I find it very frustrating. But when I, you know, speak to people in mayor's offices all around the country, they say, look, like we need the revenue that comes in from these businesses, and people need the jobs. We can't just keep these things closed down. We're going to have people out in the streets, people losing their homes. We're going to have to cut, you know, all of our essential services if we don't have the sales taxes coming in. I mean, how would you think about striking that kind of balance?
I know, you know, it is so incredibly tough, because believe me, I mean, I hear about, I see, and I feel the pain in the community. But here's the conundrum that isn't quite a conundrum, that when you kind of just look at things objectively, we all should be able to agree we're not going to solve the economic crisis until we solve the health crisis. You know, so this idea that, oh, well, if we can just ignore the health crisis or somehow just hope it goes away, which I guess is the president's strategy, then, you know, let's focus on the economy. But the fact of the matter is, you're not going to have consumer confidence until people feel safe. And so, you know, from the get-go, there should have been obviously a national testing strategy. I heard from small businesses when the state was reopening, you know, fairly quickly, I heard from small businesses saying, asking me, what should I do? Like, I'm not a health expert. How should I approach this? Very little guidance from the state, very little guidance from the CDC. We now know what was going on at the CDC, and then that there was an effort to deliberately prevent good information from getting out there. But this again kind of goes back to what I said about the needlessness of this tragedy. Yes, there was going to be a tragedy, obviously, but so the exponential pain has been something that was preventable. So we can't go back and change history, but what do we do going forward? We still should have a national testing strategy. That is still something that we absolutely need. There should be, you know, all sorts of rigorous, regular testing in schools, in universities, anywhere that people are going to be congregating on a regular basis. It's not hard. Other countries have figured it out. And then as you do regular, robust, consistent testing, you do the tracing that follows it, because the tracing is what leads you to other pockets so that you can mitigate the spread. What is so unbelievable is that we have not learned the lessons of the successes in other parts of the world.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there.
opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot-button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
As we approach the election and the question of how people can safely vote in the election and, you know, whether how that's going to interact with the issues going on with the Postal Service and all that, Latinos have had kind of uneven rates of electoral participation. And certainly the question of like mobilizing Texas Latinos has been, you know, at the forefront of Democratic efforts there for several cycles. The conventional wisdom tends to be that you need a very kind of high touch, mobilized outreach strategy to like be very present in people's lives and encourage them to vote. Are you concerned that this is going to like have that this is going to have another negative impact on Latino political participation? And do you see the kind of political structure trying to adapt to that in ways that are going to successfully reach out to voters?
I am worried, and I don't think that we have adapted quickly enough. Here's what happens anyway. So here's an obstacle that Latino communities like El Paso face anyway. We are a blue county, and as a result, we frequently get written off by either statewide candidates or presidential candidates because, oh, well, you're blue. We've got to focus on those seats that we need to flip or those places we need to protect. So there's very little investment that goes into our community from presidential races or statewide races as a result. I mean, we rarely, if ever, see commercials for presidents. Although, you know, because we share a market with New Mexico, Southern New Mexico, you know, when there's a battle there, we get the morsels, you know, but there's no major investment. And so my feeling is that over the years, that's part of what has dampened turnout or dampened enthusiasm. El Paso has historically had very low voter turnout. Same thing goes for almost every county on the Texas-Mexico border. 2 years ago, when my good friend Betha was running for U.S. Senate, after I won my primary, because yes, blue district, and so the primary is the bloodiest part of the battle, I had a Republican opponent, but I wanted to use my resources along the border. I have been and still am so deeply offended by Donald Trump and by his enablers that my view was, if the border doesn't turn out in record numbers in 2018, shame on us. But we weren't going to get any outside resources, so it's on us. And so my campaign and I collaborated with grassroots folks, with their local Democratic parties, with Beto's campaign, with other campaigns. And we had, we put together this amazing week-long border bus tour where we chartered a bus and I got 35 of my most enthusiastic supporters and volunteers. We boarded that bus and we went county to county. And we had coordinated all of this out. We had, you know, worked for like a month on it. In every county, we had coordinated with Beto's campaign to have joint rallies. We invited all the local candidates, the up and down the ballot, all the Dems. It was amazing. Then we canvassed. And so we were targeting low propensity Democratic voters, mostly Latino, knocking on their doors. And so if I was in Laredo, I was walking with a Laredo resident. If I was in McAllen, I was walking with a McAllen resident. And we were knocking on doors together, and the local resident would introduce themselves to the person on the other side of that door. And then I would say, "Hi, I'm Veronica, and I drove all the way from El Paso to tell you that your vote matters." And it was amazing, and it was the most inspiring thing. Then we drove all the way back. Our bus stopped. We had some issues with the bus coming and going, but it didn't dampen our spirits. It was amazing. And then that fall, my campaign and I focused again in El Paso only on low propensity, not only, but mostly on low propensity Democratic voters. Well, we broke turnouts in all the counties that we worked with, all the counties we collaborated with, El Paso included. We more than doubled turnout. That had a lot to do with a lot of things, but we didn't wait for it to happen organically. We're doing that again. We had a virtual, I have my stats with me that I want to read you. We had a virtual border bus tour with Beto and myself. We had 600 volunteers, and over the course of a week, these all border counties, mostly Latino, low propensity Dems, we made 368,346 calls. We sent 439,759 texts. And we ID'd voters. So we ID'd the Biden voters so that we can go back and get them, make sure they get out to vote. We ID'd Trump voters, not going to call them back. And then we ID'd undecideds who are ripe for the picking. So it's just going to take resources to get them out. But Dara, you're right. Like, it's a brand new world. COVID, we've got to think of different strategies. TV alone is not going to do it. We can't knock on their doors. People are getting sick of all the calls. So we've got to do other things like lit drop, you know, knock on people's doors, put literature, wave to them from afar, you know, the things that will still tell voters, especially Latinos who are rarely targeted, that they matter and that their voice matters and their vote matters more than ever.
Something that I've been looking at over the summer is, you know, there's some indications that President Trump has actually gained a little bit of Latino support relative to where he was 4 years ago, even as he's gone down quite a bit with white voters. And so, you know, I wonder why you think that is and how that's playing in. I think for a long time, Democrats had sort of aspirations of being competitive statewide in Texas. And that's maybe starting to happen now, but it's really seems like that's largely been driven by changes in the suburbs of the big cities rather than engagement in the valley or Latino population growth. And, you know, I wonder what you think's going on there with the message, what's not working.
Yeah, it's depressing. But this is what happens when we don't, as a party, and when candidates don't consistently reach out to Latino voters. I will tell you, a lot of the low propensity Dem voters that I have reached out to over the years, these are folks who have two jobs. These are folks who are worried about how they're going to pay for their kids' college, worried about putting, you know, food on the table. Politics is mostly a luxury for a lot of the low propensity Dem voters that I have spoken to over the last, I would say the last 4 years. And those conversations with them are tough because they feel disaffected. They feel like, you know, the rightfully so, like folks aren't hustling for their votes. You know, many of us are like, oh my God, like kids in cages isn't enough, you know, but their priorities are so immediate with their own families. And so I get it. I absolutely get it. If I had to worry about getting home, making sure that, you know, that we had enough food in the fridge and had enough time for a nap and a shower to get to my second job, you know, these are the immediate things that they worry about, but it doesn't mean that they're not reachable. This is why they're, I think, in many ways, sort of low-hanging fruit for the Trump folks. It's two issues that I've heard over and over: abortion and guns. And so this idea that, especially for a lot of Catholic Latino in Texas, I haven't done canvassing outside of Texas. I haven't canvassed Florida Latinos. And so what I hear frequently is about the abortion issue. I'm hearing more about the gun issue. But to me, when you spend the time and you listen to them, but you also talk to these voters and you talk about broader issues like the economy and like healthcare, that resonates with them as well. And either as significantly or even more significantly. So to me, it goes to show we've just got to spend the time and the resources. That's what the Border Bus Tour was about. That's what my outreach to low propensity Dems in El Paso is about, making sure that we're having those conversations and putting the resources in to bringing home people who would normally be Democrats. Now, that's not true for everybody. I will tell you, I have come across and spoken with people who have a lot of internalized racism that is shocking. And the things that some Latinos have said to me about immigrants or about other Latinos, I'm like, oh my God, wow, okay, bye-bye, I'm moving on. There's no change in this. You know, and so frankly, the president's racism appeals to people who have internalized that racism.
Is that with regard to asylum seekers at the border primarily that you're thinking of?
Yeah, I've had some painful conversations about that with other Latinos who, again, are the low propensity Democrats who we're trying to bring back into the fold, who've said, you know, I don't understand why they can't just wait in line, or I don't understand, like, buddy, there's no line. there's no line for them to stand in, you know, and when you're running for your life, if you were running for your life, you would do absolutely everything to save your child as well. And it's some of those folks who do buy into the xenophobia, and it is really truly heartbreaking, especially some who are, you know, I've had these conversations with monolingual Spanish speaking Latinos who have told me vamos a votar por Trump, and I'm just like, oh my God, it's been heartbreaking, but I don't want to be a big downer, because I have to tell you the numbers generally in the ID program, and this is Beto's ID. Beto O'Rourke is running, powered by the people all over the state, to ID these voters. The good news is the Biden team really, the ticket really truly has a fighting chance in Texas. I do believe that given adequate resources and attention, Texas could and would flip this year.
Thinking about that more broadly, when you talk, you mentioned how talking about kitchen table issues has been something that's proven effective with talking to your constituents. Are you thinking about turning people from non-voters into voters, or attempting to flip back people who may be maybe independent, conservative leaning, especially social conservatives? I think that's what we've seen among African Americans, is that there are a lot of small C conservative African American voters who do not in turn then vote for Republicans. Is that what you're seeing on the voters that you talk to?
So Jane, it's a combo. So yeah, we're reaching out to people who at one point voted Dem, but then either stopped going to the polls altogether over the last few years, or have like a history of back and forth. And so you know that they're semi-independent, or they are, I think, lost momentarily. And we've just got to bring them back. And so those are the folks we're spending significant resources in El Paso. You know, we're also, of course, targeting our hardcore Dems, the make sure that they know our message and what we've done. But the resources, I'm definitely spending far more resources on targeting those folks to grow the base, to help secure a win for a President Biden and a Vice President Harris. You know, it's because in the absence, again, of outside resources, it's up to us, I think, to mobilize our own communities and make sure that our communities deliver.
Vacations can be tricky. You already know how to book flights and hotels, but now the only thing you're missing is, you know, the actual travel experience. Because is it really a vacation if you're just sitting around like you would at home? You need a tool to get the most out of your time away. That's where Viator steps in. You can book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected. And 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries, not including...
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
I wanted to pivot a little bit and talk about the situation at the border right now. This is something that, you know, there was tremendous national attention to for a little while, both Trump talking about, you know, this caravan that was going to do us all in, and then, you know, progressives really outraged by family separation, things like that. It's fallen off the national media radar to some extent. But I mean, I know Dara covers this very heavily. And my understanding is that the Trump administration has really used the pandemic to sort of transform what policy looks like at the border in a way that I think a lot of people, you know, who aren't close to it, don't really realize, right? But he's essentially now gotten to live his dream of completely shutting it down.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've told folks, reporters and colleagues and, you know, anyone who will listen, that things have not gotten better at the border. They have, in many respects, gotten far worse. This is a president and an administration that we knew going in what his intention was. It wasn't make America great again. It was make America white again. And, you know, make America non-immigrant, basically. And he has done everything in his power to erode not just the privileges and rights that legal immigrants have earned, but also obviously completely tearing apart the asylum system that is intended to protect asylum seekers, to make it so that they can't even request asylum protection. And any excuse that he gets, whether the excuse is, oh, there are caravans, as you mentioned. Well, and there are caravans, P.S., they're just the white nationalists that are heading into communities with their guns. Those are the caravans that we have to worry about as Americans. But it was like first, oh, there are caravans coming from Central America. Then it was all of that he used, it exploited the arrivals of refugees and asylum seekers. He exploited that situation in order to sow fear and division and to really fuel hatred and further his xenophobic efforts. The wall, like, okay, now we really got to build the wall. Let's steal money from the military to build the wall, to MPP, migrant protection protocols, which is the remain in Mexico policy, which still today there are people, vulnerable migrants, waiting for their day in American immigration court so that they can fight for their right to asylum. There's still people waiting in Mexico for that, delaying their court dates, not giving people information, putting them at risk. And now we have the rapid expulsions that he claims, his administration claims, they have to utilize because of the pandemic. We also, by the way, what we're seeing in El Paso and in other parts of the border, I'm certain, is a literal shutting down of the border. As the border is being shut to only essential travel, what we're seeing is fewer and fewer lanes that are being opened as a deterrent, basically, even for those who have legitimate entry into the U.S. back and forth. So he absolutely is executing his vision of shutting down the border. And we would not have to shut down the lanes at our ports of entry if we had a binational COVID plan. You know, if leaders came together, and I've been calling on that, have been sharing with leadership here in Washington the need for a binational strategy, have talked about it at the local level with leaders on both sides of the border, have talked about it at the state level, had a meeting a couple weeks ago, a virtual meeting with the head of the U.S.-Mexico Border Health Commission, that there needs to be a binational COVID strategy so that we protect trade and our economy, but also we are a community completely interwoven, a region completely interwoven, and we cannot allow the Trump administration to continue to use things like the pandemic as an excuse to not just his horrific anti-immigrant policies, but also to shut down legitimate travel at our ports of entry.
I definitely do want to talk about ports of entry, but first, I was hoping that you could maybe talk about the rapid expulsion policy in a little more detail, because I think this is something that, you know, a lot of people haven't, because it's happened in the midst of everything else, a lot of people haven't really been paying attention to. And, you know, it's also true that it's been hard to get information about it. You know, your office, in a tradition that you inherited from Representative O'Rourke, has like done some has treated kind of keeping track of what's happening on the ground along along your segment of the border as a constituent services thing. But it has seemed that it's just so much harder to get information now than it was. So what are you seeing, and what does this policy actually look like on the ground?
And you're right, Dara, a lot of people don't even know about it. And so what it is for folks who are unfamiliar with it is, if you are arriving at the border between ports, not at the ports, but you present yourself to a Border Patrol agent between the ports, and you say either, I want to request asylum protection, or I'm turning myself in, I would like to get in and talk to a lawyer, regardless, so you're undocumented. Border Patrol agents are instructed to quickly look up whether you have a criminal history. And if you don't have a criminal history, you are quote unquote processed generally within about 90 minutes. And that processing is that background check. And if you don't have a criminal history, you are expelled back into Mexico. And we have found that children are being expelled, vulnerable children. And we don't believe that people are able to gain any kind of asylum protection. The process has so been eroded. But I think also, you know, one of the things that I have spoken to folks about here in DC is this is a bad practice in an era of a pandemic, because what we're seeing is it's like a revolving door. If a migrant can't get in one way, they will attempt at somewhere else at another part of the border. And so we're just having agents and migrants come into contact with one another over and over again. And in between, those migrants obviously become fuel for the cartels. Like, all we do is we continue to create opportunities for the cartels to take advantage of these vulnerable people, where they can make a little bit more money. I'll transport you to another part of the port or another part of the border. And so we're basically having people come into close contact with one another and then come re-contact with Border Patrol agents who then go home to their families and into the community. It makes absolutely no sense from a health perspective if that's the only lens you were looking at this through. But of course, you know, we are looking, most of us look at it through a broader lens about a violation of human rights, a violation of people's fundamental right to request asylum, and an abuse of authority is my perspective. But if all we talk about is the health component, that you're making things, this policy makes things much worse.
So I am wondering, in terms of like when we talk about this issue, because as you were saying earlier, there are people for whom this is just not an area of, you know, not everyone cares quite as much about this stuff as you and I do. And, you know, there are certainly people who see it as polarizing or either an issue that doesn't affect them, or it's kind of more trouble than it's worth for a lot of people. And how do you read the current lack of attention to what's going on the border compared to, say, a year ago? And do you think that it's important to, you know, continue to raise the profile of what's going on? Or do you think that, you know, politically speaking, it's probably better for your party to kind of continue to hit pocketbook issues first?
You know, I am a big believer that the party should lean into this issue. I don't believe that most Americans want to see kids in cages. I think most Americans, even conservative Americans, want a solution. You know, they want this issue addressed. I think the hardline Trump voters love the cruelty. I think that the cruelty is the point for them. But I would like to believe that most of America doesn't believe in the cruelty. And I think there's polling that demonstrates that shows that people want to see comprehensive immigration reform, and that they're uncomfortable with the Trump administration's approach to immigration. When I've talked to moderates and when I've talked to voters, you know, on the campaign side, who are like, oh my God, we just can't take everybody in. Right. I totally understand that. But Donald Trump has yet to find a solution. None of what he's done, not the wall, not remain in Mexico, not the rapid expulsions, not children in cages, not family separation. None of that has stemmed the flow. So until we address the root causes, until we have leaders who will work throughout the hemisphere, work hand in hand together collaboratively to address the climate crisis that is driving some of this, to address the drug wars that fuel some of this, drugs that are consumed by the American public. You know, until we get to the root causes, then are we going to continue to spend hundreds of billions of dollars on things that don't work? Like, how can that make sense to any American voter or taxpayer? And so I feel like it's how we talk about these things. So my point is, like when I'm talking to voters and I'm saying, you know, until we're addressing the root causes, we're going to keep seeing, and we're probably going to see an increase in refugees running for their lives, fleeing famine, fleeing violence. So isn't it about time we have leadership that can get to the root causes? And I feel like there is a way to talk to voters about this issue and to talk to taxpayers about this issue. And it's my belief that Democrats should be leaning in on that.
So I do want to kind of talk a little bit about salience per se, because, you know, you keep coming back to the kind of shorthand phrase kids in cages, which has obviously been like a very powerful, I don't want to say meme because that's trivializing, but like in the literal term of, you know, an idea that is shared among people and that kind of takes on a life of its own. It's become a very powerful meme within Democratic and center left circles. And you and I both know that, like, the problem right now isn't generally kids in cages because of the rapid expulsion policy. And before that, you know, Remain in Mexico and the other kind of pilots is.
But it seems like Trump externalized it. And that when our officials were keeping kids in cages, Americans were very exercised about it, right? It became a not in our name kind of thing, a this is not who we are kind of thing. But it feels like the president and Stephen Miller and the Border Patrol have successfully solved what was sort of bothering, I don't know, like middle class white liberals about this, which is that it was happening in our country by our people. And if we can get the Mexican or Guatemalan authorities to keep people maybe not in cages, but in squalid refugee camps, and if the Border Patrol can just turn them back right away, he's sort of demobilized people on this subject. And to me, that speaks to the fact that, you know, Democrats, I mean, I think you're right, right? People didn't like the cruelty of that. I mean, some people did, but most people didn't. But there's not a real answer, I think, on the question of who do we take? Like, who can come to the United States and who can't? Because, you know, these stories are very sad. But I was in, I guess it was last year sometime. I was in San Antonio. I was visiting my wife's family, but I tried to dabble in a little reporting. And it was true that you started seeing asylum seekers coming, you know, not just from Mexico, not just from Central America, but people from the Congo who had transited to South America and had then made this incredibly arduous journey to the border. And then they were there in San Antonio because there's more translators, I guess, there than in McAllen. And they were trying to make it ultimately to Portland, Maine, which I guess is where there's a Congolese community. And I'm incredibly pro-immigration, pro-immigrant person, but I do think it's hard to avoid the conclusion that that's not a good system, right? That people should not be on this crazy trip through Panama and dealing with all these smugglers, right? That if we want to have refugees, like there's a process for that. And you know, so it's hard for me to know, like, what exactly Democrats are saying about this issue.
Well, and I'll be candid. I think Democrats are not saying much. And I think part of why Democrats are not saying much, and, you know, I do not agree with this approach. I think we should talk about it. And I think it's, again, I think we should lean in. It is a tough issue to talk about. It's something really difficult to tackle, you know, and to tell a voter, for example, well, you know, we should be addressing the root causes and let's talk about the climate crisis and let's talk about, you know, the famine that comes from it and let's talk about drugs. It's a lot, you know, and I think you're right, Matt. Like a lot of people are like, well, we can't take everybody in. I hear that a lot. And we can't solve everybody's problems. And, you know, America can't be the landing place for everyone. But here's what we do need to acknowledge as a country. And this is where I feel like we need to hold a mirror up to ourselves and be honest with ourselves, which I know is a tall order. But when we were getting the Central American families who were coming in late 2017, you know, all the way until MPP was initiated, they were being, of course, held in horrific conditions in El Paso. I mean, you all know about families that were held outside, sleeping on rocks under the, you know, under the bridge, the port of entry, or these horrific concrete cells, you know, filled. It just, you look in the windows and there was a sea of humanity, like these awful conditions. And then they'd be released. And our volunteers in the community, led by Ruben Garcia of Annunciation House in El Paso, had the you know, these hospitality centers where volunteers would provide meals and clothes, and, you know, doctors and nurses would show up and provide care. And so, you know, as a volunteer, I made meals, I'd buy meals, I'd go serve meals. I'd sometimes sit and eat with the migrants if we were done serving everybody, and I'd sit and I'd ask them, you know, where did you come from, and where are you headed, and how long was your journey? You know, you learn a lot about what they're going through. I would tell you probably 90% of the migrants that I spoke to during that time, they all, 90% of them had a family member in the U.S., either a husband, a wife, a child, a parent, who had been in three main areas of industry, either meatpacking, agriculture, or construction. These are the people putting food on our table. These are the people building our communities. And they want to be reunited with their family? Oh my God. You know, and so here we are saying, you know, yes, we're okay with American corporations getting wealthy off of migrant labor, making their profits. We're okay eating the food that, you know, came to us as a result of backbreaking work in the fields. You know, we're okay eating, you know, for non-vegetarians, I'm a vegetarian, so I don't eat this, but eating my burger or my bacon that came from a slaughterhouse that, you know, employed migrants. But I don't want them to be with their children. I don't want their wife to come join them. We have to have that conversation as a country. Are we okay with that? Now, there's going to be a large contingent that will say no, and they shouldn't be working illegally. And, you know, that's why we need ICE raids, et cetera, et cetera. I've had conversations with some of those farmers, with some of the folks who run these companies, and they'll say, I've raised salaries. I've done everything possible. This was pre-COVID, to hire people, and I can't hire folks to replace them. It is a difficult, long conversation, and it's complicated. And so maybe that's why people are like, well, let's just talk about something else.
Bringing up kind of Annunciation House and the volunteer network of people who were, you know, super mobilized and are interested in kind of providing a support network, even regardless of how the government is treating people. It's interesting to me because my only visit to those welcome centers was in, I guess, October of last year. So like after MPP had gone border wide, and it was this huge empty space, mostly empty, you know, a few Brazilians, because Brazilians were not yet in MPP. They would be put in later, and some of the African immigrants. But like, because the changes have been so rapid, I mean, even I was thinking before we started taping, like, I assume you've been in Congress longer than you have, because there have been so many successive border regimes that, you know, we've been trying to, that you and your colleagues and I and my colleagues have been trying to figure out from our respective sides. But, you know, that kind of brings us back to a certain extent, indirectly, to what you're saying earlier about ports of entry, because one of the effects of the rapid expulsion strategy is that it's just harder for the volunteers on this side of the border to get to the communities they're trying to serve. And I'm wondering, like, yes, that sounds like a very compelling reason to let people travel. Yes, people who, you know, have family on the other side of the border, or who regularly need to cross the border for, you know, for their work, or for to just like buy the most affordable groceries, that kind of thing. Like, there are lots of compelling individual reasons, but at the same time, you know, it does seem like there's a good epidemiological case for minimizing cross-border movement generally, especially when Mexico has, you know, especially when like each country has certainly failed to contain its own epidemic, but Mexico does appear right now to be in a very, very bad position. How do you kind of weigh those two competing goals? Because, you know, it's I'm sure that you get a lot of complaints from people who are being restricted as they're shutting down lanes, but there is, you can kind of see a collective argument there. So how do you weigh those?
You're absolutely right. And, you know, it's but to me, it's like, you know, if we're trying to reopen cautiously and try to preserve the economy as best we can, and if we've agreed we can't stay shut down forever, and going back to my comment before, like, you've got to attack the health crisis first, that's why we need a binational COVID strategy. Let's say things get better in the U.S. and that we flatten the curve and we're somehow able to overcome it. Let's say it takes 6 months. Who knows how long it'll take. And Mexico is not up to par, and Mexico's cases are still rising, or they're still not doing a good enough job. The case might be, even under a Democratic president, like, oh, we've got to be careful. We can't, you know, we've got to close ourselves off. We can't live like that. We cannot live like that in a border community. And so everything that I've heard from the Mexican side, from my contacts in Mexico, is that Mexico isn't doing a better job of testing and tracing because Mexico doesn't have the resources. So my view is, if we can adequately fund the U.S.-Mexico Border Health Commission or NGOs to do this, I mean, my God, Trump sent ventilators to Russia. Surely we can help with testing with our neighbor, who is our most significant trading partner for the southern states like Texas. And so I'm hoping that on the economic front, that will be compelling. You know, for me, we've got to let people be able to, you know, come and visit their doctors or do whatever that they need to do. We are one region. And there's certain aspects of border life that, as careful as you want to be, you know, just like in our daily lives here in the U.S., there's a certain amount of it that has to continue. But you've got to address the health crisis. And so you do that with a binational plan where you work in concert with one another. But we don't have a president that's willing to do that. So without a binational COVID plan, the U.S. might be doing well. If Mexico's not doing well, I'm afraid we won't reopen the border. So we've got to have a good binational strategy. We have to.
All right. I think we're going to let that be the last word. Thank you so much, Congresswoman Veronica Escobar, Texas 16th Congressional District. Thanks, as always, to the Texas Tribune Festival for, I guess, not really having us down to Texas, but it's a great festival.
For now,
it's a great show.
For now owing us, so that next time you're going to have to bring us down to Texas.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we're all having tacos at home, or burritos, as the case may be. So thanks so much. Thanks seriously to the Texas Tribune. Thanks to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. Thanks to the Congresswoman. And the Weeds will be back on Friday.
Support for this show comes from Fundrise. Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise Flagship Fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise Flagship Fund to your portfolio in just minutes, and with as little as $10, by visiting fundrise.com/fox. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise Flagship Fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Claude 3 from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point of the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skill and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who use Anthropic to navigate this new frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude, C-L-A-U-D-E, today. Jumpstart your genius with Claude 3 by Anthropic.